Welcome to the PDH online course on the 2008 National Electric Code. Let's talk about Article 300, Wiring Methods. Article 300 lists available wiring methods and identifies proper uses and forbidden uses. As technology keeps advancing, innovations are offered to the marketplace to reduce materials costs and labor. This describes most of the additions to Article 300 in the last 50 years. The old methods are individual conductors in raceways of rigid steel, intermediate steel, thin wall tubing, flexible conduit, and liquid tight flexible conduit. For institutional and industrial occupancies with an expected life exceeding 20 years, these are still the preferred methods. For speculative office buildings and warehouses or retail buildings, the innovative methods often make the difference between financial success and failure. With the understanding that many of the innovations trade low first cost for higher life cycle cost, the decision revolves about risk tolerance of the owner, designer, and building standards office. Some building standards offices are extremely risk adverse. This is usually well known in the community, but may be a surprise to outside investors. I'm presently working on a job which is considering direct bury 15 kV cable for a remote treatment plant. This has been an accepted utility means for many decades, but is considered innovative and risky in the water treatment industry. I'm recommending it because of higher reliability than existing overhead utility service, so that we can avoid the permitting hassle for an emergency generator. Section 310 lists all the variations of conductors, insulations, and jackets that are approved and limitations regarding their application. The key summary is Table 310.16, allowable ampacities for not more than 3 current carrying conductors in raceway, cable, or direct buried. Anyone who is doing detailed electrical design must have a copy of this table at his workplace. The conservative design standard is to call for an 80-degree C cable, like XHHW, and apply it at 60-degree rating, or that would be TW. A very powerful design aid is a table with columns for circuit breaker, power conductor size, ground conductor size, and conduit size. A further aid is to include a key, perhaps in a hex box, and use the key on one-line diagrams instead of repeating the information on each 10-horsepower pump. A sample is included below, and this is his actual real-world sample that has been used for over 10 years by my employer. And there are some extra columns on here. I think it's described here in the text, which we will be getting into. In this version, the 7 left-hand columns are in a non-plotting color. That means that you can see them on the screen, but you don't see them on the paper. They're used for design, but not shared with the installing contractor. And those columns are, a heater at 280 volts rated in kilowatts, and the column reads 3 kilowatts, 5 kilowatts, 6 kilowatts, goes up to 45 kilowatts. Next column is heater at 480 volts, and the kilowatts start at 7 and go up to 100 kilowatts. Now, getting into the columns that are reproduced in the drawing set, we've got a hex number, and they go from 1 to something like 44 in this set. The column following that is three-phase 208 volt horsepower for HVAC equipment. Next column is three-phase 480 volt horsepower. And again, this is for larger equipment, industrial equipment, and some HVAC equipment. Then the maximum amps per the code, number of parallel runs. And as you might expect, these are a single run down till we get up to 500 amperes, talks about two runs of 250 kcmil, number of wires in neutral per conduit, and this is where the table splits, because let me get this right. I don't want to confuse you. I don't want to confuse me. If it's a three-wire circuit, then it requires a different conduit size than a four-wire circuit. So if we're carrying the neutral, it's more cross-section, requires a larger conduit. Now for the table that is actually reproduced here, all of the conduit sizes are a little bit on the generous side. This makes it easier to pull in the field it has been my employer's decision that this is the right way to do a design, and I would call it a conservative design, and I do endorse it. There is a column for the ground wire size required. So this combines several different tables from the National Electric Code, the first being 310.16. If the color red shows up on the key 16 face conductor, that's because we used this chart for over 10 years with a wrong value in that cell. The red is a reminder that this is the revised chart. It doesn't show up on the copy I have. I suspect it won't show up on your copy either. There are three important derating factors for table 310.16 as follows. This is for no more than three current carrying conductors. If harmonics are present flowing through the neutral, then there are four current carrying conductors, and the ampacities are reduced to 80% per table 310.15.B.2.A. 80% applies to 4 to 6 current carrying conductors. Further derating is required for 7 plus current carrying conductors. Sidebar discussion on the special case of wire mold 4000 in section 376.22. Section 376.22 provides an exception for a medium large wireway similar to wire mold 4000. Up to 30 conductors can be used without derating. This is extremely powerful for situations where you must relocate a panel board or must accommodate especially intractable interferences. But back to the list of derating factors that should be applied to 310.16. Table 310.17, temperature correction factors, requires 13% upsizing of 90 degree C wire, XHHW, at temperatures above 104F. The correction is 29% for upsizing 60 degree C wire at 104. 104F is special because it's the temperature limit for most NEMA devices, programmable logic controllers, and such. Sidebar discussion of derating for temperature, mostly ignored in the past. The comment in the main text suggests that 104F is a reasonable limit for industrial ambient. This is true at floor level, but grossly in error for steam tunnels inside near the roof or outside on the roof. I was tiring easily on a previous job when I was physically pulling data cable in a steam tunnel near the ceiling. A precision thermometer reported 140 degrees F where I was working. By OSHA, this is life-threatening. By Table 310.17 correction, it requires 42% upsizing of 90 degree C wire, and 60 degree C wire is not permitted. Further, 140F is commonly reached in poorly ventilated attics and inside near the roof of plants. In the past, it's been extremely rare, perhaps even unknown, to upsize such conductors. The 2008 National Electric Code includes Table 319.15.B.2.C for derating conductors run across the roof. A 30 degree F derating factor must be added to the measured ambient for heating by the sun. If we have a 70 degree ambient, which is pretty mild in most parts of the country, that is 104 degrees F for the derating factor, which we've been using as our threshold previously. 110 ambient, which is not unusual in many parts of the country, requires a derating of 140 degrees F, which was the one we were looking at just a moment ago. It will be interesting to see if we get comments back from Plants Review Office on this. I will certainly mention the requirement to HVAC designers. And again, let's return to the list of derating factors for 310.16. Don't do diversity. There are several sections of the code that suggest that equipment running at less than full load can be fed by less than nameplate amps. That is forbidden in other sections. There are several sections in the code that permit overloading a feeder for non-coincident loads, that is, not on at the same time. If you read the wording closely, they almost never apply. If you have two pumps, you must lock out the second while the first is operating. Well, no process engineer is ever going to agree to this. He wants a lead lag connection, so the second pump comes on when the first can't keep up with the load and is probably fouled on the impeller. There's a section in cranes that's been quoted for reduced supply capacity, but it applies only to cranes. The correct way is to size your motor control center for the expected loads plus a reasonable future capacity. Then size the feeder to the motor control center by the nameplate you chose for the motor control center. There's a hidden diversity factor here, but you are following the exact wording of the code. Similarly, when you size the main distribution panel for a building, you do not sum the installed circuit breakers and use that number for the main. We know that it's rare for a feeder to run at 50% load and very common to run at less than 20% load. This has been verified by field measurements consistently for decades. After you tell the utility you have 500 kVA of load, they have you share a 200 kVA transformer with the guy in the next industrial plant. They know, and they don't have to follow the National Electric Code. Section 314.21 forbids a crack more than an eighth of an inch around a recessed electrical box. Now, you might say to yourself, how does this belong in wiring methods? Well, this is in wiring methods, and it's something worth talking about, and I'm not defending the organization of the National Electric Code. This is a wonderful example of an explicit measure of craftsmanship that the contractor must respond to, enforced by the code. When you see unpatched cracks, I recommend that you go to the roof and inspect the liquid-tight flexible steel conduits to the HVAC equipment. Unless they are supported properly within 6 inches of the box, they pull out the first time snagged by a ladder. And this is another craftsmanship issue. Also look inside electrical panels to see if the outgoing conductors are trained within the gutter space. Again, this has been good practice for years, but is now required by Section 210.14.D. Jumping ahead now in Chapter 4, Article 404 discusses switches, mostly light switches. There are rules which must be followed, but no hidden problems for the designer. Unfortunately, the 2008 National Electric Code does not address a very real problem in lighting control: energy conservation. Most states have an energy code, and many construction projects are seeking LEED certification. The result is that the electrical designer who does lighting control must consider daylight harvesting, dimming, motion detectors, building automation override, emergency override, janitorial override, and more local switches than he would like. Why? One state energy code explicitly requires daylight harvesting controllers with a local photocell and an analog dimming command to dimming ballasts. True, the only commands are 100%, 50%, and off, but if you are in that code, in that state, the code there mandates dimming controls. So you've got to have a little more sophisticated box, and perhaps a lot more sophisticated box. There are three considerations on an energy conservation lighting design. Copy the controlling requirements from the state code or LEED manual and put it in the construction documents. You do this to help the later battle with a construction manager who sees a value engineering opportunity. Find a well-documented product which is certified to the state code or LEED and use their installation details, and or let a lighting consultant or lighting rep do the detailed design to earn his commission. Did I have this conversation before? I don't feel bad about using a commissioned salesman in this capacity if we're sole sourcing it. If the owner has decided that he's had real good experience with this particular brand and that's what he wants in the addition or the new building, we know it's going to one guy. Let the guy earn his commission. If we're planning to bid it to three guys, it's really hard for me to say it's a service to the owner to make it so only one can easily bid on the project, and two are going to go through a lot of machinations and probably objections from the guy who wrote the specifications that he slipped something in there that only his product can apply. But again, you have to make your decision on your own project. Article 409 refers to industrial control panels, and this sounds a little more innocuous than it is. Almost anything that does control is an industrial control panel. Article 409 discusses industrial control panels, which have been interpreted to include building automation system panels. Panels must be fed with a circuit rated 125% of the nameplate full load current. What is the nameplate full load current? If you buy an industrial control panel, it must have a nameplate that lists the full load current. And that's the kind of requirement that we're getting out of this National Electric Code that never existed previously. The requirements for 2008 National Electric Code include a nameplate with the following six items. Manufacturer's identification. And this may not be easy when an OEM subs out fabrication. Check the title block on the shop drawings and the installation manual. Supply voltage, phase, frequency, and full load current for each incoming supply circuits. Fabricators really don't like to look at separate control power sources they require and external signals that qualify as voltage sources. Short circuit withstand. Now, Busman, the fuse people, have an excellent discussion on their website why a substantial incoming protective device may not protect against a downstream fault. The reasoning is that a large industrial machine may have full load current so high that the impedance limited downstream fault is less than full load, and the fuse just sits there and smiles while the wiring out there burns. Another requirement for industrial panels is a service entrance sticker if the device is being used as a service entrance device. This is common for a motor control center at a remote pump house to use the main as the service disconnect. Also very common if you've got a transfer switch at the incoming. To manually switch over to a receptacle with a portable generator. The requirements for industrial control panels include an electrical wiring diagram. They must state the NEMA enclosure type. Please note the following three significant items missing from the National Electric Code requirements. Prominent identification of each energized conductor. The code recognizes multiple sources and requires external disconnects for each, but does not include notification inside the enclosure as the locations of each. A good controls panel spec calls out a color, usually yellow, for energized external wiring. A good control spec calls for prominent labeling of each incoming power connection block. Touch safe connections. This is an IEC standard that can be provided by all major United States suppliers. It looks like a bolt-on Lexan cover. Again, the big guys who buy a lot of panels put it in their spec. Be especially careful on door-mounted pilot lights. Old-style, oil-tight 120-volt pilot lights have big terminals on the back, and the fabricator may even have a loose conductor strand sticking out. Nice to back into while you're noodling a controls problem. And the final missing requirement from the National Electric Code is use of a subpanel and adequate wireways. NEMA figured this out many years ago. UL certainly knows. Established panel fabricators know. New engineers just out of college don't know, and a firm that's just starting out in panel fabrication may see a value engineering opportunity. Control devices should be mounted on one or more subpanels, which bolt onto the main enclosure and each carry a grounding conductor. There must be room to bring in a bundle of control conductors, make a 90-degree bend, and fan out to the control devices. A line in the purchase spec gives you something to talk about when you review the shop drawings or first take delivery and don't like what you see. Section 410, lighting fixtures. Section 410 is about lighting fixtures, mostly residential. Please consider the following field test data regarding industrial fixtures. I wondered why I was getting advertisements for $13 Jelly Jar Maintenance lighting fixtures. I really, really like Jelly Jar Maintenance fixtures with a screw-in compact fluorescent light source. So I bought 6 fixtures from major U.S. manufacturers, mounted them on a 2x6 board, and smashed them in turn with a baseball bat. Conclusion is as follows. The $13 unit is worth $13. The $65 Hubble unit is worth $65. It was the only unit to survive a standard whack. This was very scientific. The whack with extreme prejudice broke the guard and the globe, but left the base intact. And this was the only intact base in the series. The test sequence was recorded with still and video cameras. It's exactly what you would expect. Not very interesting, except how far the glass and guard pieces flew. Section 410.30 relates to pole-mounted outside lighting fixtures. There are several little-known requirements as follows. A non-hinged pole must have a hand hole giving access to incoming conductors in the ground lug. A hinged pole still needs the ground lug. You can put a security CCTV camera on a light pole, but you must maintain separation between the power and low voltage conductors. The code vaguely suggests a raceway or cabled power conductors instead of loose conductors. It also mandates vertical support of all conductors per section 300.19. It's good design to provide a local ground rod for each light pole. Some state highway departments require 2 ground rods for each pole. Metal halide lamps must have a lens. The code reports fires from arc tube failures. 410.130 requires individual disconnects for non-dwelling fluorescent fixtures. This is easy if they're plug connected, as the plug is a qualifying disconnect. Perhaps the manufacturer will start putting a Molex pull-apart connector on the power leads inside the enclosure. This would be a lot cheaper than a switch. I haven't seen them in commercial fixtures yet, but they're common in high bay industrials and roadway lighting. 410.141 requires locking disconnects or disconnect within view of the fixture for outdoor electric discharge lighting over 1,000 volts at the lamp. Section 600.6 requires a disconnect with locking means on the outside signs. This has been a local requirement for many years, but goes national with a 2008 code. Section 600.21 says that a neon sign ballast located in an attic or soffit requires a work light. Someone somewhere is using pruning shears, and rather than subject you to that, I'll come back later. Might be a good time to take a drink. Of water, of course.